Welcome to the Space Cave. I'm your host, David Huntsberger. Let's find out about planet Earth from up here in the ether. Hope you've got yourself something warm and cozy to snuggle up to and listen to this episode. A big warg to all of you. I should make a cool sound effect thing for that warg. Maybe Dan can put some effects on that. All right, let's get right into it and check in with a citizen of planet Earth.
Hello?
Stephen Elton Yates.
Hey, David Huntsberger.
How are you, sir? Green Circle Award winner.
That's right.
Excellent. Hey, I'm doing well. It's nice to talk with you. I was kind of holding off because you and I have a date with a full recording with beers in hand, but I'm glad to get a little check-in as well and see what's going on in your life.
Excellent. I'm on the road right now, but I have time to kill, so I'm really happy that you called.
Okay, cool. Well, hopefully you have 5 to 10 minutes or so, and we'll catch up on everything that's going. I know you sent me a video link recently about a performance you did live, and I have not watched it. I apologize. I absolutely will, and it would probably have behooved me to do so ahead of this, so we'd have something to chat about. But maybe we can share it or tweet it or something like that if you want it to be publicly. And if not, I'm totally flattered that I'm included in your inner group that you would share that with.
Well, there's a second part to that. I performed, quote, to put that squarely in quote, a little number on my guitar and singing at a benefit that was near our town. And my son followed me. I knew better than to follow him. I'll send you a link to his performance directly. He can really play. And he had the crowd going crazy. Oh. Nothing makes a father happier than seeing his son succeed.
But there also must be a part of you as a performer going, damn it, he really outshined me.
I'd be lying if I said that wasn't true.
Well, it sounds like it was a success for both of you. So that's great, man. And I'm sorry I have not seen it yet, but I will. This I vow to you.
I'm sure you will, and again, don't get your hopes up on mine, but just know that there's something better coming.
All right. Well, what's going on with you, man? What's got your attention, or what's on your mind in the world these days?
Well, you know, I tell you, I have just recently kind of sworn off the sort of media cycle that I seem to have found myself trapped in. Of, you know, obviously we started the political season early, and I find that most of the discussion that I see in the media these days is extremely polarized. You know, I guess I show my age where I seem to remember a time when people could discuss things, even if they differed in their opinions, sort of respectfully. I'll listen to you, you'll listen to me, I'll point out some things that you did right, you'll say some things that I did right, and maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be an idea whose time has passed, sadly.
I saw an article or something a while ago where, like, Dana Gould at his keynote speech at the Montreal Festival was like, everything's a competition now. Like, even on the your local news, when they talk about the movies, they don't say, like, you know, here are how the movies did this weekend. It's they smashed the box office, this one ran away with everything, they won, they clobbered, they annihilate. Everything's competition. And I guess with our infatuation with sports, it's built into us, especially in the United States, of just kind of everything must have a winner and a loser, in spite of how much it seems like with children we try to have, hey, everyone's doing well, everyone's doing great. And I know that gets perpetuated as if that's the only way kids are raised nowadays, is on soccer teams where things only ever end in a tie. But politics,
right,
is,
everybody gets a trophy.
Yeah, but I don't, maybe that's not the case, because it's certainly, as you go higher and higher up, it is winners and losers in everything. and for politics to become so much like wrestling with, here's what I'm going to do, and that guy's an idiot, I'm going to crush him. Oh, you think that about me? Wait till you hear what this guy did. And everyone's just being so rabid. And,
well, yeah, you know, that's a very accurate assessment, I think. And, you know, the only thing I've seen recently, and you probably saw this, maybe it was a year or more ago, Bill Nye, the science guy, there was a debate about evolution, I think, versus creationism.
Yeah, and, where he sat down with the guy.
A fellow from the Creation Museum.
Yeah. Yeah, did you watch any of that stream?
Oh, yes, I saw the whole thing.
What'd you think?
It was remarkable for the civility with which it was conducted.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Nye obviously feels very strongly about evolution and science and whatnot behind it, and I don't disagree with him, was very respectful of the gentleman from the Creation Museum. And he let him speak, and he tried to understand the points that were being made, even as he disagreed with them. And I thought to myself, and as a parent trying to instill good values to now grown children, I said, you know, that no one owns all the truth. And there's, you know, there's some truth on both sides of almost every issue.
And I love that.
You know, anytime you find somebody who's so strident and so, like you said, like a wrestler wanting to win, they have to understand that no one's 100% right on any sort of complex question.
Yeah, I love that no one owns the truth. That's pretty great.
Right.
You should get t-shirts.
Well, I'm a very profound, Green Circle, they don't just give that away.
My girlfriend and I did our big road trip, and I did the canceled tour. I kept seeing those billboards for truth, and I called one of them. They have things like the, you know, evolution chart sort of crossed out. And when I got home, I called and chatted with this guy. And I think the normal banter that he was used to when people would maybe do that, or just people in his day-to-day life, would be to meet it with kind of a hostility. And the one I was calling to essentially get some advice from was raising his voice a little bit or kind of cutting me off. And I just kept kind of letting him do it and then sort of, okay, well, I just think within that, and by the end, we were kind of chuckling together. And, you know, he'd been raised on a very conservative, in a small town on a farm, and raised very like fire and brimstone biblically, and had this very weird skewed version of what evolution was. Like, well, a man can't turn into a pig. And I thought that was just baffling. Like, well, here's where I think you're a little misguided. And then he would kind of, by the end, we would, you know, agree with each other on certain things, or just asking about like the compassion element involved with just being a human, let alone religious. And like, you know, how do you guys feel this way and be so certain about something where you're supposed to approach it with love and openness, and that seems to be the best tenet in any religion. And yet to change that around to where you're just screaming at people and spewing hatred, that just seems odd to me.
You know, I'm actually a Sunday school teacher, and I do a unit every year about skepticism and atheists. As Christians, what should our attitude be?
Right.
And, you know, I always start with, that, you know, if you're a Christian and if you follow what Christ said, then love has to be your response to pretty much everything. Even if someone totally disagrees with you, your first response should be, you know, a loving response to them. And then you can discuss and try to reason. But at the end of the day, even if they remain skeptical or non-believing, you have to wish them well. You know, there's just not enough of, as you said, you know, I think your opening remarks were right. It's all about that wrestler mentality of, if we disagree about anything, then I win and you lose.
Yeah.
And that's that.
It
seems to me that's going to stifle progress on an ongoing basis when you're trying to, especially when it comes to science, because science is all about the open exchange of ideas.
Yeah.
And as soon as I say, I'm not going to show you my notes because you'll use them against me, then science has become stifled. And I'm showing a lack of confidence in my reasoning by not wanting to expose to you, here's why I think what I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a bad feeling to give up ground or to step back. And I feel like having a discussion with people, it would behoove both parties going into it to just off the top, almost like fighters weighing in, kind of go, before we get into this, how often do you acknowledge that you are incorrect and acquiesce? Most people would go, I do that a lot. I do that all the time. You go, no, you don't. You really, most people never do. And it's a hard thing to go, oh, yeah, you are right. I got to rethink a lot of things. And that would be a big starting point, I think.
You know, I think in a lot of, I'm not a couples therapist, but what I understand is that one of the approaches that they use, if you have spouses that are arguing, you say, okay, to the husband, tell me one thing she says that's correct. You know, tell me something that's valid, that she, you know, point that she's making. And so once, when you start with that, then that starts to bring you closer together and reduce the distance between the two parties. Whereas the approach that's normally taken is, here's where she's wrong about this, and here's where he's wrong about that, and that just expands the distance.
Oh, absolutely.
There can be no meeting of the minds. And so, the global warming debate is one that I'm very familiar with, and there's very little communication, open-minded, you're right, I see the point you're making on this side, but here's a point I'm making on my side. I would love to see more of those Bill Nye debates on other topics, because I think it would set a wonderful example to, all of us, that you can have a discussion of, with someone you polar opposite opinion with, but you can have a civil discussion. And maybe that might bleed off into politics someday, so that people could say, well, there's two views on this, and they're both valid. And I happen to subscribe to this one, but, it's not the end of the world to think about the other one.
Well, I can see why you've been happily married for so long, and I think that is such a progressive approach. And I the thing that gives me hope is that the politicians make up such a small percentage of who we are, and with our access to communicating with one another digitally or globally, that we can kind of ignore them in a certain way, and we can do things like not necessarily even calling them debates, just discussions, and right, saying, like, if you guys want to adopt this level of thinking and come around, like, we as people can set the example, and you lunatics can slowly swing back down to where you're actually functioning as normal citizens, as opposed to these caricatures that aren't even really humans. They're just these odd puppets that are so bizarre. And anyway, I'm looking forward to chatting with you more in a full episode too, so we'll get
I am
fully
looking forward very, very, very much, David. I'll keep an eye on your travel schedule, and as the date gets closer, well, I'll have to search out a good beer for us. Look forward to meeting with you and enjoying a couple of those.
That sounds great. All right, Stephen, I will see you then. Thanks, buddy.
David, thanks for calling. Take care. Love Space Cave.
Thanks a lot, man. See ya.
As I walked along, my steps grew quicker. My skin began to tingle. There was some sort of residue burning in my nostrils. I knew I needed shelter, but I did not know how. I hadn't been to this place before. I looked down and saw the unmistakable signs of scat. As I examined it closer, it turned out to be that of alpaca. Looking to my left, I saw said alpacas, and the gentleman carrying them was nice enough to give me a lift. These alpacas carried me to the summit, but when I looked back, their precious fur, wool if you will, was covered in blood, making it significantly less valuable. Chapter 2, Fighting Your Way Out from the Inside. And Gary, I just wanted to do this one in one long take, and don't check my heart rate. That is a given. When you are...
Sorry about that. I don't know what that was. Anyway, a different frequency. All right, Stephen Yates. Good to hear from that guy. I will post those videos. I've seen both of them now. Both really cool. I think you'll like the one of his son. He really rocks it out. And Stephen's is good, too. It's got a kind of a Neil Youngish quality to it. I think it's a Beatles song? I don't know. I it's been a while since I watched it. I apologize. But you'll like it. It's good. So I'll put those on thespacecave.com. Let's get into part two of our conversation with Dan Pritchard from Australia, talking about exotic fish, breeding them, species going extinct, and how we can, the collection aspect of it, and just a lot of different things about guppies. I'll put up the video, the 40-minute Guppy Expo show, where they just show a picture of a guppy, and then they show that guppy in real life. Like, the picture is just a sketch. Here's what this one looks like. And then you see that real guppy in real life. So it might give you a better idea of how you would judge a guppy contest. I was mesmerized watching the video when he sent it to me. Had no idea those things existed. And it just makes me feel like Dan is a pretty interesting fellow, which I think you'll find as you listen to our conversation. So Here you go. Here's part two of that.
Back with Dan Pritchard talking about what do you call them? Exotic fish?
I just call them aquarium fish because we've got the freshwater guys that might be in lakes and streams and rivers in freshwater, and then your saltwater ones, which are obviously in the ocean. And I'm mainly a tropical fish hobbyist, so fish that live in warm water, you know, 18 to 30 degrees Celsius. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, sorry. Yeah, and so they're quite colorful.
So if you went to the Bahamas or Fiji, or I don't know where else you'd go to get somewhere in the tropics.
Fiji, I've been to a few times, yeah.
And so say you go snorkeling and you see a fish. Do you instinctively want to grab it, or do you take a look at it and go, oh, it's got that stripe, like that, that's a garbage fish?
No, I instinctively want to own everything. There's nothing quite as beautiful as a tropical reef with all the different fish and crustaceans. And
you could kind of name
it's just amazing.
You can name every species when you see something like that?
I've got some of the Latin, but I know a lot of the common names. So when I've been snorkeling, it was just absolutely amazing. The first time I went, I think I was 11 or 12, wasn't given any shark knowledge, which concerned me, but no one else seemed to be worried. So we just went out on this reef, and it was amazing. I mean, but parents had to basically drag me out of the water. So that was a really great experience. Then the second time was great too, except I sort of drifted over this chasm and really scared myself. So I was like 2 meters from reef, 2 meters from reef, and then nothingness. So I was like,
were you scuba diving or snorkeling?
Hey?
You scuba diving or snorkeling?
No, I was snorkeling.
Oh, okay. So you could just pull your head up and then see. Sure. Oh, but yeah, that'd be pretty frightening.
Yep. Yeah, no, it was really frightening. The third time, I was staying for about 10 days in a resort, and they had a reef on the lagoon, and so we went out there, and that's when I saw my first sea snake.
Ooh.
So, laughing time was over then. So I might just head in for a while.
What is, this is probably something I've read, I'm sure I have at some point, that like 80% of sea snakes are not harmful, but then the ones that are really, really deadly. Is it something like, is that in the realm?
I was just drifting along, heading in one direction, and then the snake was underneath me about, I don't know, 5 or 6 feet, just sort of shadowing me, heading in the same direction. Mm. I was like, ooh, I think I'll just drift. I think we're both having a good swim here, but I think I just made a bit of a wide turn back towards the shore.
Yeah. And how did you... So that reef thing of suddenly their nothingness, I mean, that... I guess earlier in the conversation I was thinking of this, but then that in particular seems very Finding Nemo-ish. How do you feel like when you watch that movie and they, you know, personify or anthropomorphize the fish? Do you suddenly go, oh man, what am I doing? I'm the bad guy in this movie. I'm scooping them up. I'm selling them to dentists.
Well, see, so with saltwater fish, I just ended that. I was into saltwater fish and I realized all the damage that the people were doing to the reefs, and, you know, smashing reefs to catch fish and poisoning fish, you know, anesthetizing fish. And one day I said, just no more until this can be sustained, because they're starting to breed reef fish. And in America, I think, you know, there's a big industry in breeding reef species. Until all the species that I can get are, you know, farm bred, fish farm bred, I'm not having saltwater fish anymore. Just ended it. Boom. Finished. Because they're really hard to breed, some of these saltwater, well, most of the saltwater species, the freshwater species are much easier to breed and keep.
Ideally, you would be working with the saltwater species because they are easier to breed and keep. And
what the saltwater are the hard ones, fresh, easy.
Oh, sorry. I heard
that's all right.
Fresh. Okay, so you are in a better situation now because you're dealing with the easier ones. But I think like you're in a, not a conundrum, but a contained cycle where you could justify going out and not doing damage, obviously, to get the fish, but that you were taking them from their natural habitat, because you would say, well, I'm growing this population. population. I'm protecting this species, but you still would rather like wait until it's more ethical.
I'd rather wait until it's ethical. But I mean, early fish guys were like pioneers. They'd go up Amazon tributaries looking for fish, mainly German guys, some English guys, and or European. And, you know, they'd find new species, they'd box them up and bring them back. And they still do that to this day, find new species, bring back a few hundred, and that's all you need to establish a domestic, you know, sort of farming program. Yeah, you know, and because fish can interbreed quite a bit because they normally exist in a fairly small area, so they're genetically set up to do a lot of inbreeding. But you sometimes get to a point where, you know, you're starting to get too many mutations and you can't do it anymore. Two-headed fish and all that sort of thing.
Really? Wow, because I was going to ask you about, like, not necessarily highly noticeable mutations like two-headed fish and stuff, but, you know, if you want to have these certain type of spots or a stripe over the nose and you're, you know, being very careful on what fish you introduce to this population, how many generations do they go through before they start naturally having little evolutions and little mutations and adaptations and things? I mean, can it just...
I can't say for sure, but I mean, quite a few hundreds, I would say. A lot of the species that that have the deformities are actually quizzically some of the ones that move the least in their life. So they may be born, live and die 10 meters, you know, in a 10 meter sort of circle, but they're the ones that we seem to have ruined because we just got carried away with that information. we took that as a gospel and just interbreed them until, you know, they start to not have bottom jaws or have half a dorsal fin and stuff like that.
Because you're getting hundreds. I mean, what's the gestation for a fish? It's,
well, you know, for the guppies, it's 28 days, but they're born live. And then with your egg layers, most tropical fish, you know, 2-3 days. But some can be up to 12 days.
So you were going through a lot of generations in 1 year.
Yes, yes. So they're genetically very stable as far as mutations. I mean, you take like a guppy variety, not even a species, but just a color variety, say ones with, you know, blue spots and green fins. They'll live in just a creek off a river. Mm-hmm. And because the creek, it might only get flooded out a couple of times a year, because they don't really want to enter the big river, they just hang out in the creek because that's a flow of water that they understand, you know. So they'll just hang out there and they'll be all the ones, what did I say, with blue spots and green fins. So, you know, they'll be for thousands of years, they'll just live in that little tributary, and so they've got to be genetically very strong to deal with all the inbreeding.
And so the blue fins and...
But yeah, blue spots, green fins, I think we had.
Blue spots, green fins. That's going to be hard. Blue spots, green fins. So that their traits are like a dominant trait that they would keep passing on. Because like, if say there was a bunch of inbreeding in a variety of different species and you had this creek and it doesn't get flooded, and is there... Yeah, I guess that answered my question, because I was thinking over time and enough generations, like, what does every fish move toward? Does it just get all muddled together to where they're all just kind of boring, sort of troutish looking fish? Or would they, the strongest traits, no matter how many?
Well, yeah, you've got camouflage, you've got breeding, so you've got showing off to mates. So but first of all, you've got to live in the environment. So you've got to be a color and a form and a shape that makes you be able to not be eaten by predators, live in that water flow, eat the food that's available. So, you know, so you might have a flat top because you're just eating from the top, like guppies. They have a flat top. Or you, in the midwater, so you might be just eating stuff that just flows by, like a big family of fish called tetras. They just sort of, whatever's happening, and it's mouth-sized, they'll put it in their mouths. So, yeah, so they're just eating in the flow. And then you've got catfish that are flat with their mouths facing downwards because they mainly eat on the bottom. You know, so in that little creek we're talking about, we've just not got the blue spot green fin guys. We've also got catfish living in the bottom layers. We've got midwater species. And, you know, we've got predators probably too, you know, but they might cruise in and leave, or they might be there full time. So, you know, you've got all these different fish living in this one little tributary of this river, of the Amazon that we're talking about. But it could be anywhere. It could be Asia. It could be Australia. And Africa, of course. So, you know, that's your main tropical bits. And so,
and then how... Yeah. When those, you talk about the guys that go up and find new species, how often does that happen? I mean, is
it's
it one of those
right now as we speak? I'm sure.
So it's constant, and yeah. Do people have, like, you know, they'll say for say the Amazon that we've explored, you know, 2% of it or something like that. Is it similar with species of fish? We're like, oh, we're just scratching the surface. Does the fish community feel like they have a pretty good bulk of research done, or is it still wide open?
I think the fish community would say that we're 90% there. But it'll just be areas of Africa, areas of Asia, and just creeks that people haven't bothered to go up and have a squiz, have a look.
See, well, I mean, in you know, mountain creeks and streams and places I've been, it just seems impossible. One, the temperature would be way too cold. So how do you find these creeks, and what do you look for exactly to go, oh, there's going to be pretty fish in there?
Well, you know, the heat seems to be the qualifying factor for the fish to be attractively colored. I'm not sure why that works, but I think it's got something to do with, you know, most of the freshwater species coming from the saltwater species. I think there's a connection there. They want to display to their mates, to their mates, as in not friends, as in females that they want to have sex with. You know, so they'll have long finnage and they'll be highly coloured and stuff like that. And they also want to say to other males, go away from my territory, if they're a territorial species. And, you know, so you're dealing with that band of the planet, the tropics and the subtropics. So it's a case of just going and having a look, setting some traps, swooping some nets around, and see what you find. That's what they do.
So you just kind of sit there and wait, sweep a net along. You don't, like, bury your face in there in a snorkel and look around and hope you see a fish.
They're scared. They get scared by stuff like that. So you set your net overnight and you come back in the morning and have a look at what you got, and you're just sort of tossing the common ones over your shoulder, so to speak. It's toss, throw, pitch. Ooh! And you say, this looks a bit new. Let's put it in a little viewing tank. And have a look at and see what we got here. And a lot of times, once you're experienced, you see different things straight away. Like when I'm breeding my guppy varieties and stuff like that, I'll just be walking past the tank and I'll go, yep. I'll stop on my heel and go, so you see different things straight away. So, the trick is, well, we there's no use taking one of these things. Now we need 200 of them, you know, a shipment.
How do you find your net has one, and then it is the most bizarre looking fish you've ever seen. It looks like a clown's wig. And you go, this is unbelievable. And then you go to look for more, and there are no more.
Is it unbelievable, Dave? It's inconceivable.
Inconceivable. So it's that was not the best impression.
Oh, my impressions are legendarily terrible. I can't tell jokes, can't do impressions.
Can I hear it once more?
Inconceivable!
It's too nasally.
It's rearing up here.
It's gotta be higher. Inconceivable.
Inconceivable.
No, now I've gone in falsetto. No, it's not really. It's not really.
It's fun. So it's completely inconceivable that there would just be one weirdo looking. They tend to happen in batches, I guess. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, out in the wild, a one-off mutant doesn't last very long. It'll get picked off. So
which
you'll say...
This thing about evolution, isn't it?
Yeah.
That one-off thing, like the fish that has the sort of built-in fishing rod that comes out and hangs a little worm in front of its own face, and then other fish. That's unbelievable. How did the first one... There was a batch of those? Initially created, that's inconceivable. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, I talk about one of the weirdest fish I've ever kept is a splashing tetra, which a male and a female get together and then they find a leaf that's hanging over the water but not in the water. Then the female jumps up, hangs on with the little fins, lays eggs out of the water, then drops back down. The male hops up out of the water, fertilizes the eggs. Then he drops into the water. Then he stays there for a couple of days splashing the eggs every so often. It's quite a humid environment in the Amazon. And then when the babies are born, they just boop, drop into the water, and then they're on their own after that. But, you know, that's work? Evolution.
For the predators in that area, you just know there's food over there. That guy's splashing his eggs. I'm going to go eat that guy. I mean, it just seems like that would be impossible for that trait to evolve and or continue.
Well,
because to splash those eggs, you'd have to dart over, maybe splash and then head back to a safe spot.
So, you know, here's the thing. Like tetras are an enormous family of fish. Most of them are just egg scatterers, whereas they just get together in some plants and just whiz the eggs around and sperm around everywhere and say, yep, job done. Good job, everybody. So that's how most tetras do their stuff. So the babies are born, the many hundreds of babies, and then three get to live, and then that's how they go. So it's competition in the Amazon for tetras to live. It's very, you know, it's a very tense environment. So the splashing tetra has come up with this idea, oh, we're not just going to scatter eggs anywhere. We're going to jump out of our atmosphere. It's akin to a couple deciding to go and have a baby in space, shooting a baby into space. I mean, that's how wild this planet is.
Seeing it firsthand, and yet where you're seeing it in these tanks and stuff, it's got to look pretty serene most of the time, unless they're roaming around sperming all over the place.
This is what people kid themselves into, is saying, you know, fish are relaxing until they have to clean the tank and they're dealing with diseases and all that sort of thing, you know, but the ideal is them being relaxing.
Oh yeah, there's something I wanted to ask you about, kind of along those lines. Is like, you were going to try to do some crossbreeding or genetic splicing and create a new species. Is that really...
Yeah, a new variety of guppy. Yeah, a new variety of guppy. I wanted to call it the David Huntsberger.
Sweet. Well, tell me some characteristics of this new guppy.
Well, I didn't actually get there yet, but I started off about 3 years ago developing my own guppy varieties. I got up to about eight different types, different varieties. It's really rewarding to produce your own guppy variety, Dave. It's like producing your own labradoodle or something. Davidoodle.
Yeah, well, you know, Kepler was influential in astronomy, and they named so many things Kepler based. Like, in anytime they find a new planet, it's like Kepler 482b, Kepler 501. So maybe you should just make them all the Pritchard guppies.
Yeah, maybe I should.
Yeah, but get your own stamp on those guppies.
Yeah, well, I started off with pretty pure Endler's guppies, which are a separate species of guppy, and then crossed them over, you know, regular old guppies. Now, what are Endler guppies? I think they're Policia wingii is their Latin name, and regular guppies are Policei reticulata. Anyway, I crossed those two together, and I just got a lot of things that weren't very fun or interesting.
But well, what is fun or interesting about a guppy? I mean, when I think of like an aquarium and the tropical fish, and some are very narrow, and then there are those ones that have like the fins that are like lace, and then they kind of drag all around them, or really high fins, or big unfurling flag-like tails.
Yeah.
What is cool about guppies?
Well, they've got the big unfurling flag-like tails is what's good about them, and they also have quite long dorsal fins. They're easy to keep. They're quite laterally compressed, so they're quite... they've got a good viewing side, but they're not so laterally compressed that they look like an ocean fish, you know, like a brim or something like that, you know, like a tuna, real fishy. they don't look so fishy.
Yeah. The last thing I want when I look over and see fish is for them to look even remotely fishy.
But funnily enough, the endless guppies, they don't have long, unfurling, flowing tails. But they do have all the other characteristics, which means that you can put them in with other species that can be a bit nippy, because a lot of the guppy tails get nipped by, you know, nippy species. So you can still have guppies, but they're not the really long-tailed guys. But so you cross them over with the regular guppies, and then I started to develop... The first variety I developed was the Sharpling Blue, named after legendary comedian broadcaster Tom Sharpling. So it was an all-blue guppy with one single spot in the middle of its body, one black spot. So I got one male, but I found his sisters, or what I thought his sisters were, in just a general brood tank, you know, with hundreds of guppies. So I put him and his sisters in a tank, and continued to collect the fry separately, and then I put his kids back with him and back with his sisters until, it took about 7-8 months, I suppose, to purify them. And then every fry that came out of that tank was about sort of, 95% like the first one, like the Uber Dad.
How many cycles do you have to do to where you can... verify that it's that you got it, that you have a new species?
Guppy breeders will scream me down on the internet. Just wait for the comments to come in.
into a firestorm here, my friend, because this is the preeminent podcast of guppy fanatics around the world, so you are going to get crucified.
But I normally find that it takes about 6-8 generations, being pretty strict, to get it in the 90%. But then it's ongoing, so in 3 years I've only been working with guppies varieties breeding. I've had guppies, I've bred guppies before, but this is the first time I've intensively dealt with them. It could take quite a few years to get it up to 100%. I don't know.
You're in for it. You're committed. You want to see these guppies take off.
Yeah, well, I mean, financially it doesn't really get you anywhere, but the Asians are really great at producing new guppy varieties. They've got the climate and the water, which is also important. And you see a lot of great Southeast Asian guppies come, and they're just like peas in a pod. When you order 10 of them, you can hardly tell them apart. So they're really good at it. But another family of fish I've worked with a lot is African cichlids. So cichlids are a really big family of fish. You don't have them in Australia. There's a couple of Asiatic species, but there's loads of South American, Central American, and African species of cichlid. And I've done a lot of work, in particularly with African cichlids, just keeping them pure, not so much developing new varieties, because that's not really the point with them. The point is have the purest one that look most like ones that might be photographed in the wild. That's what you're trying to achieve.
And okay, so that's the point. But beyond that, like the bigger reason for doing that, for keeping them pure, is to show them or to re-release them at some point?
No, not re-releasing and showing off. that's the point, to say, you know, I done this, but you know, not to members of the opposite sex or anyone you might be interested in going to bed with. That is that is not the way to impress a potential sexual partner with your prowess in fish breeding.
Really? Because you're married, so this impressed somebody at some point.
Yeah, but I'm other things. Yeah, I haven't found any girlfriend that's taken too much of interest in fish, except to say, you know, they're pretty.
And, well, you're a musician as well. Is that what lured her in? Your prowess on the keys?
Might have been. She's a musician and I'm a musician. That might have been it. We both got small brain damage from head injuries. That might be some of it. And but you know, but we like the same sort of entertainments and music and stuff like that. That's probably it.
And the brain injury was just a joke, or you guys each have?
No, my wife had a what's the good one? Benign brain tumor about 4 years ago removed. And so that's not very funny, but I had a hilarious brain injury where I used to love to get in just as the sun was rising to feed all the animals. Because I figure, you know, I left there at about 5 or 5.30, so by 5, 5.30, 12 hours later, they want a feed and a drink, right? You know, so I've been an early riser, so I went over to the shed, and, I'd sort of change up a bit. I'd start with birds one day. The other day, I'd start with rabbits. But this particular day, I said, oh, I'll start with a fish. And the last thing I can remember for a few hours is saying, I'll do the top ones first, and jumping up on the ladder. And then you know, about an hour later, I just woke up in a pool of ladder water and blood and fish food. So I no one was there, but I can actually manage that, you know, the ground was slightly slippery and the ladder just slipped away under my not insubstantial weight, and I just came down flat on the back of my head. Well, that's where the injury was anyway, because it's got this cross of scar in the back of my head, and I just woke up and with this almighty headache. I eventually got myself to casualty, but I couldn't work my phone. I could dial the numbers, but I couldn't work out what went. I couldn't work out what this green telephone icon meant, so obviously I was quite heavily concussed. So wow. I escaped casualty, or whatever you would call it over there, ICU, or somewhere where you go when you're hurt. Emergency. Mm-hmm. And so I escaped that and went home and had some tea and toast before then. My mother worked with me in the shop at that time, and I said, oh, I should go to the hospital, but first I want to go and feed the fish, finish feeding the animals, you know. I've got to finish feed the animals because the animals will be hungry. So went over and fed the animals, but then after that I went into shock and started vomiting. And so anyway, I went back to emergency and had all those concussion things where you can't remember the day or your name very well and all that sort of thing. But anyway, and that was it.
Well, so, you love fish and the animals well ahead of that, so it really didn't change you.
No, it didn't change me, but I don't have a sense of smell anymore. My olfactory nerve was severed or ripped, or I don't know. The neurologist didn't say. He basically said, "Yeah, you're never going to have a sense of smell," and gave me a kick up the bum out the door. You know, basically, you say, "Look, you're lucky to be alive. Off you go. Stop wasting my $400 an hour time."
Well, that could be the no smell could be pretty good when you're working with all those animals, or do you miss the smell of all that?
It was pretty depressing because smell and food goes together, you know, because you really only taste salt, sour, you know, bitterness and sweetness. Everything else you get through your nose, so you know, the bouquet of vegetables and fruits and all that sort of thing, you really get through your nose. So it was a little bit depressing. It changed my diet a lot. It made me a potato chip addict, not yet recovered, but still trying to get off the potato chips. I mean, one day with a lot of support, maybe from the internet, I can kick potato chips.
A good potato chip commercial. I love them because I had a brain injury.
Yeah, the thing about potato chips is that they have the saltiness, which I like, and they also have a crispness. So they've got two good things going for them there. But I couldn't eat bananas for a long while because they just tasted like sweet mush, which is not something I enjoyed pre my brain injury. So, but I got back into the swing of everything, and now I barely notice it, except I quite often leave the gas on after cooking.
That's
gentleness. I made the work car overheat once, and I never knew. And the boss came out. I said, "This car's overheating." The boss came out and said, "Can't you smell like the engine is burning?" Because I never told them, of course, that I didn't have a sense of smell. And I was like, "Oh, my goodness, isn't that weird? Oh, what a crazy happenstance." Anyway.
Weird. Well, you've got a lot of... you've battled through these obstacles in your life.
Being Australian, a white, male, privileged...
Yeah, tough one.
Bald.
How many types of animals do you have?
Just rabbits, guinea pigs, birds, and then a fish, and then cats.
They're not all for sale, just the fish.
Just the fish and the rabbit. The fish and the rabbits and the birds are, and the guinea pigs, and not the cats. The cats are just pet cats.
Cats.
I don't believe in keeping puppies and kittens in cages for sale, unfortunately. That's not...
Yeah. Do they try to get after the birds ever?
No, they're pretty well trained. They find that out pretty quickly. It only takes a couple of weeks, really, before they know. No chasing birds. And then they... Of course, they do chase wild birds.
And how many different types or species of birds do you have?
Well, the birds I predominantly sell, so I mean they come and go. I mean, you might have 12 or 15 types. At the moment, coming into Christmas, because we've got a few days off, I've only got 4 different types. But you know, I've bred quite a few different birds in my time. You know, cockatiels, lorikeets, budgerigars, finches, poultry. Some
what was the one? Budgerigars?
Yeah, budgies.
But I've never heard of those.
Oh, they'd just be parakeets that you would see. You could call them parakeets, yeah.
I was like that with Australia. It's a parakeet. We call it a budgerigar.
A budgerigar, yeah. But they're just shortened to budgies.
Budgies. And then how many types of fish?
Oh, look, 50 or 60. Generally, but that's at the low end for an aquarium. Like we're not a very very big aquarium. Some aquarium shops with hundreds of tanks would go into hundreds of species. I'm sort of in a area that I'm only keeping 20 tanks going currently. That's plenty for me with my other work, you know, my internet work and all that sort of thing. So only some hours in the day. Damn it.
Yeah, man, keeping up with comedy and podcasts and a million other projects. You must not sleep a lot.
I generally sleep about 5 hours a night. I got into the habit of that when I was a gigging musician all the time. You know, it's sort of just got into the habit of that. And it's heaps. What did Leonardo, I was going to say DiCaprio, how much sleep does Leonardo DiCaprio get?
That's what we're all wondering.
I mean, he's an acting genius, some people might say, but really I meant to say Leonardo da Vinci, of course. He only had very little sleep, and he done all right.
Yeah, yeah, he did pretty well. So someone comes in, you've got these 50 different varieties of fish in 20 cages, or 20 tanks, and someone comes in they say, well, here's what I'm looking for. Are you basically just telling them which fish will not be eaten and or eat other fish? Or are you trying to give them an idea of like, well, here's what a good tank looks like. You need one of these. You need one of these. I mean, how do you guide people?
So that's then when the, now let's commence the dance. You know, you sort of think in your head, all right, so what have you got? What sized aquarium have you got? What are you aiming for? What level are you at? A lot of customers are return customers, so I know basically what they've got. I'd say, oh, I've got this in, I've got that in. I remember you saying you wanted one of those. I've kept it aside for you, or, you know, something like that. But newbies, you just try and get them to have a few basic species that are easy to keep. You give them some ground rules for fish keeping about water changes and water, you know, parameters. Mm-hmm. And just try and keep them honest. But it's, I mean, it's very hard because people don't they value hobbies like this very highly. And, you know, when you consider children, work, house, and you know, all that sort of thing, you got to do.
And then for fish, that's, you know, in the hierarchy, it's up there. Do you go with, what do you instruct them to have in the bottom? Those little pebbles, little rocks? Do you want them to have a castle in there? Should they have a bridge, a fake mermaid?
There's nothing wrong with, you know, all these resin ornaments that China has provided for us. They're absolutely fine. They seem to be, you know, way in the high 90s safe, and they look really good. It's much better than taking rock out of your native habitat around, you know, which is probably illegal anyway, but there's a lot of great rocks coming out of Africa. If they're imported, they're probably legal. I mean, they're at least legal in your country. I don't know whether they were gathered legally or not, but I mean, you can't be an international aquarium rock policeman. Not all of us can anyway. So, you know, let's have some cover for the fish. Let's have some aquarium plants in there, which means you need to have adequate lighting, and you need to have the right water parameters for the species that you're keeping.
All right, so it's up to you. Beyond just having the right light and filters and the temperature and that sort of thing, everything else is decoration.
Yeah, it's just beauty is in the eye of the beholder sort of thing. See, when I was breeding a lot of cichlids, they're quite big fish. I'd have tanks that were 200 gallons, 300 gallons, stuff like that. So they would need a lot of caves and cover and stuff like that because of the aggression. So from the aquarium store, I would have like smashed ornaments and stuff like that, and rocks that people just didn't care for. You know, they didn't have any nice features. So I just tumble all this stuff into the tanks, and you know, so I built that up over years and years and years, that whenever I had a new species or needed to set up a new tank, I'd take, you know, smash castle A with broken bridge B, you know, and cobble together something, and then I'd have people come in and say, oh, your tanks are so beautiful. And I say, well, yeah, you know, well, even chaos gets it right every now and again. So you know, just do it to your own, to what you think looks nice. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of aquarium products, of which I use 12, but that's all right. I'm really, you know, I'm really nipples deep in it all. People don't need to worry about what I'm doing. Just, you know, try and do right by yourself.
But you encourage people to do it. But then you earlier said that it's kind of a handful with staving off diseases and cleaning it and stuff. So what is the overall like allure of having the fish?
You won't go too far wrong as long as you don't get too excited and get something that you can't handle. Like a 50-liter tank or 20-gallon tank with a few fish floating around with the right filters and lighting is something that almost anyone can handle, even if
why do they want to do this? What
because it's pretty and relaxing. It's quite relaxing to watch the fish float around, and they're attractive. And when you get the plants and a little bit of tiny log and stuff in there, it's almost like you've created your own little planet. that you've got a lot of control over that, even more control over you've got the family dog or the family cat or something like that, you know. So you can have all blue fish if you like blue, or you can have all your what's your favorite football team, Dave?
Oh, they're gold.
You could have all goldfish and and theme. But if you switched over to being what's Boston Red Sox? See, you could have all red and... Are they red and black and white? You could have all red and black and white fish or something like that.
Do you deal with a lot of... evil genius types? I mean, in movies, they always have a fish tank. So you have people come in and try to, like, rig up their, palace or...
There's a lot of weirdos in fish. When you get deep into any hobbits, you get really deep into a hobby, whether it be comic book. I mean, I'm also a comic book guy. You find a lot of weirdos. So I'd float into Sydney to pick up some fish, and I'd go under this person's house into their fish cave and stuff like that. And you'd be trying to, because I've got a retail background, I'd be sort of open. And say, hi, how you going? How about this day? All that sort of thing. And they'd be like, fine. So you want some fish? You can't buy them. Oh, I didn't want to buy them. Well, you can't. Okay, fine. They're far too rare. Okay, great. But then you get chatting with these people, and you know, most people are really nice. Doesn't matter what country. Or where you are in the world. Most people are nice. And so you buy the fish you want, and maybe you buy a bit extra, and then lo and behold, because you've built a rapport with this weirdo, you end up leaving with the ones that you definitely couldn't buy that were too rare. You know? So you meet a lot of really interesting types. I don't know whether I've come across an evil genius.
You got to be on the lookout
maybe
for him.
Maybe I'm the evil genius.
You know, now, you, if you were, well, yeah, maybe
if you walk into a room and you can't identify the evil genius, maybe you're the evil genius.
Nah, evil genius, because they're always, you know, planning things out. They're making videos. They're threatening. They know they're evil geniuses.
Yes, I don't threaten in my videos.
All right, man. Well, when people hear this, you will be the one who compiled it and put it together. Any last things to plug or put out there in the world?
Oh, yeah. All I can say, I'm a writer. I want to get to America and work on a show. I've got a lot of TV ideas. I've got a lot of movie ideas. I've got some full screenplays. What would set me apart from a balding, podgy white guy? Other balding, podgy white guys that want to be screenwriters and work in America is, I guess, my long career in small business and the entertainment business means my ideas are a bit more fully formed than, hey, what if we got Amy Poehler? Let's start off with Amy Poehler. I start off with the idea, and all my ideas are fully formed and they work on paper. Now, whether they work in 3D, I don't know, but give me a job in America. Give me a job in America, Dave.
Oh, I thought you were going to plug maybe some fish you had on sale or something. But
no,
listening and you run a television or movie studio,
yeah,
please let Dan send you his stuff. He's got a lot of ideas. They're fully formed. He's put a lot of time into it, and they work.
I've got a great movie idea for Jason Mantzoukas. Do you want to hear it?
No, we are finished. We've come to our conclusion. I don't want you pitching me movies.
Okay, sure. Well, I suppose you don't want to hear about the David Huntsberger movie. That's
no,
fine.
Thank you. No, thanks. But it was nice chatting with you, buddy.
Okay, mate.
Thanks for all your help on the show. And if I get some fish, you will be the first person I call.
Yes, call me.
All right.
Call I can't spell fish. Just Skype me.
All right.
Thanks, man.
See ya. Dan Pritchard, thanks for the time. Thanks for engineering the show. Thank you guys for listening. I hope you enjoyed our chat. And hope to get down to Australia at some point and see that fellow in person
and potentially do some stand-up comedy and whatnot. Thanks for rating the show on iTunes, being a totally independent show, no network, no ads. It's the most beneficial thing you can do for me and the show, so I appreciate those of you that have done that. It feeds into those metrics and, I don't know, some sort of analytics things or whatnot. And you can also get my CDs there. If you go to davidhunsberger.com, you can get links to my animated stand-up special, One-Headed Beast. It's all about the mind and the brain and things of that nature. So if you're into that, I hope you'll enjoy it. And if you'd like to be on the show, email. Go to the website, the contact page, and love to have you come on into the Space Cave, share a frosty point, and chit-chat about things. So anyway, I think that's it for this episode. Play a song here that I don't know. I don't know who gave me this. At one point, I was like looking through something, cleaning some stuff up. I don't know. And I found this CD that was given to me at some point, but I don't remember by who. So if you are out there, let me know. Or if you know who this group is, I think it's delightful. I want to say it's Nicole, potentially, in Minneapolis, but and if it is, I apologize, but I really genuinely don't remember who gave me this. But I have in the past mentioned country music and how modern country music is the worst thing happening on the planet. And I know you went, but nope, still worse. But then someone gives me something like this and goes, here, this is something that's a little newer. And this may even be a cover song, so I don't know how new it is. But the sound, that's what I'm getting at. The sound is kind of that old style, which I love. And this is Hat and Boots. And if you are Hat and Boots, get in touch. I apologize if I forgot your face to go along with. But I have listened to the music. And this is called I Could Be by Hat and Boots. Please let me know who you are. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.
Well, you could be the wind's push forth a thousand more sunny days. Could be untold to show me that it's okay if I don't know some things. 'Cause you are more than anyone could know, whether you now, just like a falling leaf freezes, thaws and comes back green. I will never leave, just as I was always.